as an entity that's now been termed post-intensive care syndrome family.
Families are just devastated.
This is what differentiates exceptional clinicians from just good clinicians.
They develop this feeling of almost what's like a learned helplessness. We feel these things of frustration and sometimes helplessness too.
Nurses are even better than we are at this.
Welcome back to Critical Care Perspectives in Emergency Medicine. Mike Winter is here from the University of Maryland, joined by three amazing superstars in emergency medicine and critical care. My co-hosts and colleagues, Dr. Peter W., Dr. Rod Rodriguez, and Dr. John Greenwood. Gentlemen, how are you this podcast?
Doing great, thanks.
Likewise, doing very well.
Wonderful. Good to be back.
Peter, did you survive Mardi Gras? Yeah,
we survived Carnival despite a couple of mass casualty incidents. It was exciting times for us, but a good job by our ED and trauma crew.
We were chatting before we got the recording started, and you said you had 20-plus trauma activations or MCI event in the span of, what was it, just an hour, maybe hour and a half?
Just under an hour and a half, 22 activations, full-blown traumas, two separate MCIs that abutted each other, and then our normal knife and gun club overlying that.
Now, these kind of events, you know, in terms of Carnival, common, or is this even more so than normal?
So this is more so. So we get an uptick during Mardi Gras time and all the parades, but this was a bit over the top. You know, we see the routine, you know, five or six or even seven or eight all within a 20-minute period of time. But to have 22 spread out over an hour and a half was a bit much.
Well, kudos to you and the crew down there for sure.
Well, thanks.
Rob, last time we chatted, there was quite a bit of weather and heavy rains out your way. How are things now?
Cleared up for about a week and a half, but rain's coming back. And in fact, some hail in addition to the rain. So a little bit more exciting weather in store for us.
John and I haven't had too much in terms of, we've had extremes in temperature, not necessarily weather. We went from 80 last week, or almost 80 degrees here on the East Coast, and then I returned from a quick trip out of town to 15 degrees today in terms of Fahrenheit. So markedly wild swings here on the East Coast. So we'll see where the next few weeks gets us. Now, gentlemen, the topic for this podcast is really based on a case that I had last week. Before leaving town, I was working an evening shift in the ED, got signed out, and in one of our resuscitation bays, and we do walk-arounds now in our ED in terms of patient sign-out and transition of care, came upon a 50-ish-year-old female. She was in her late 50s. She was not from the Baltimore region. And unfortunately, she had fairly advanced metastatic gastric cancer. And she was being treated north of here in a different state at a different institution. And her family had taken her, she'd actually been doing okay. Family decided that they were going to do a weekend trip down south for a family wedding. And she had started to get sick during the time that she was at this other location down south. In fact, went to a local facility, had an evaluation, and they were really on the fence as to whether she has her oncologist and all of her family. We're just going to take her home. So they left AMA, got in the car, started driving north, and right as they started to pass through Baltimore, she really had a rapid decline. In essence, she crashed as the family was trying to speed north to get her home. They pulled off Interstate 95, called EMS, and she was brought into our facility. Respiratory distress, a whole host of things. She was quite ill, markedly altered, had a tremendous amount of electrolyte abnormalities. In fact, she had acute kidney injury as one of her conditions and a potassium level above 8. And the family, as I took over the care, you could tell that they'd been up most of the night trying to get her home. They were exhausted. They were anguished, trying to go through the medical decisions as to how aggressive they wanted to be. Should they intubate? Should they not intubate? Should they start dialysis or not? It was really, really taxing for this husband and daughter that were trying to make these decisions there immediately at the bedside. And as I watched those next few hours play out and interacting with them, it's really not unlike many of the circumstances that we encounter in the ED or in the ICU. And a lot has been talked about recently about family-centered care in critically ill patients. And as we launch into our discussion, new guidelines were just published in the last month in critical care medicine pertaining to this topic of family-centered care in the ICU. And in terms of family-centered, it's something we've touched on before, but not really in depth, in that a majority of decision-making in our critically ill patients does fall to surrogates, to family members. And more than 50% of patients that are critically ill that ultimately make it out of the hospital have significant disability, and that burden also falls to the family. In fact, studies would show that up to 50% of family members of critically ill patients experience acute stress syndrome, anxiety, depression, even post-traumatic stress disorder. And it's an entity that's now been termed post-intensive care syndrome family, not only in addition to the patient, but also now recognize consequences in the family. Guys, have you encountered any of this? This is kind of a hot topic that we're talking about, but have you seen this play out in the ED or ICU?
Well, Mike, I can say that I see this a lot, and this can come into the ICU in maybe an acute patient who there was an expected cardiac injury, or with the acute type A dissections that come in, families are just devastated. And we have opportunity to talk about kind of what the protracted course is expected to be. But over time, over the course of a week or so, they develop this feeling of almost what's like a learned helplessness. And some family members tend to disengage, some withdraw, others are kind of actively engaged for a long period of time. But you have to have this conversation right at the get-go to help them kind of expect what's coming. This is whether in the ICU or in the ED. I try to broach the topic in the emergency department in critically ill patients, but this is definitely a really important topic. What do you think, guys?
Yeah, I would agree with this, 100%. It's something that many take for granted, but really this is what differentiates exceptional clinicians from just good clinicians. Their ability to tune into this and the needs of not just the patient, but the patient's family.
I completely agree. Having been through this experience personally with a family member, and I knew what to expect. I knew what was going on. Obviously, I was familiar with all the machines and all the procedures that were going to occur and that were occurring with my family member. And I still left that experience with what I would call post-traumatic stress. It was very difficult. And if you can imagine our patients' families who are not familiar with all of this, it must be obviously even more traumatic. So I agree, it's a very important topic. It's something that's not given enough attention, and I'm glad we're talking about it today.
One other thing, as we're getting into this, this is not only a stressor on the families, but also to clinicians as well. I mean, I can't tell you, me personally, when you're dealing with an emotional family, time after time again, this can really impact our care or have an impact on our ability to provide exceptional care. We feel these things of frustration and sometimes helplessness too, as you're trying to help these families through. So this is definitely an important topic, not just from basically an aspect of providing care to a patient, but also care for each other.
Couldn't agree with you more, gentlemen. Now, in terms of the guidelines that were just published, the lead author is Davidson, and we will certainly put this reference in our handout for the podcast, titled Guidelines for Family-Centered Care in the Neonatal, Pediatric, and Adult ICU. This was just published in Critical Care Medicine, and in essence, the objective of these guidelines was to provide clinicians with evidence-based strategies to optimize the support of family of critically ill patients in the ICU. Now, admittedly, this is for patients in the ICU, but as we've talked about over really since this podcast's inception and trying to standardize care regardless of the location of the patient, we can certainly take a lot of pearls out of this document, and it is very much applicable to the critically ill patient boarding in our ED and waiting ICU admission. Now, with respect to these guidelines, they were not simply an update of their initial set in 2007. In fact, they underwent a new and much more rigorous analysis of the literature, trying to bring about what is the current state in the literature and the evidence say about family-centered care. So they compiled an interdisciplinary team of 29 members. They used not only literature search, but they actually incorporated interviews with patients and family members to get some much more qualitative data and direct consultation incorporated into this document. It's pretty rare that you see that incorporated into national and international guidelines. Overall, they included over 230 articles on this topic, and they came up with 23 recommendations. Now, certainly we're not going to go through all of those. We're only going to go through a handful that is pertinent to both the ED, critically ill, and ICU patient. And I think before we even get into these recommendations, it is important to say, even though they had over 230 articles, that this is still an area ripe for research. And in fact, a lot of the recommendations are based upon low level of evidence and their overall weak recommendations simply because we don't really have RCTs on this particular topic. But gentlemen, let me get your thoughts on some of these select recommendations. And let's start off with some common ground between ED providers and intensivists dealing with family presence in the ICU. And one of their first few recommendations is that they suggest family members of critically ill patients be offered open and flexible presence at the bedside that meets their needs while providing support for staff and reinforcement in working with families. So we want their families at the bedside and engaged in care. Peter, what are your thoughts on that recommendation?
So I support the recommendation with one caveat. There needs to be a navigator in the ED or in the ICU whose sole purpose is to support the family and can meet the family's needs and kind of coach the family as the rest of the providers need to pay attention to the patient and the resuscitation of the patient.
Rob, what do you think?
I support it as well. However, I think it should not be a mandated or universal thing. You shouldn't necessarily pressure family members into doing this. Some people are just not ready to be at the bedside for a lot of this. You have to play it by ear, really. You sort of have to gauge the family's ability or interest in doing that. And as we do with many things, kind of adjust your plan accordingly.
John?
I think this is clearly something that's important. And it's important more in the dynamic periods of the patient's critical illness when there are potentially a lot of decisions that have to be made. I think one of the caveats for me is always, you know, I talk to families when they come in and say, this is a marathon, it's not a sprint, and you need to take care of yourselves just as much as you're trying to take care of your loved one. So having unlimited hours is great during really important care times, but certainly there are times in the middle of the night when you have to encourage families to take a break, to shut their eyes and try to get some rest, allow us to do some of the hard work. Most of the literature on this is fairly observational, and there hasn't been any RCTs, obviously, on studying unlimited family time, but it makes sense that family members, they have crazy lives as well, may need to work during the day, so it doesn't make sense to hold banker's hours in the emergency department or to ICU for family visitation.
All right, gentlemen, great start. Let me go on to two more family presence in the ICU recommendations. And this next one, I'll be honest, I used this during sign out in this particular case last week in that I brought the husband in during sign out rounds. So he was a member and hearing and listening about the presentation. We were showing him the labs, her x-ray, and involving him more so in rounds. And this next recommendation from this panel of experts suggests that family members be offered the option of participating in team rounds to improve satisfaction with communication and increase family engagement. John, let me start with you on this one. What are your thoughts?
I think it's wonderful from both a clinical perspective and from my workflow perspective. For me, it saves me a little bit of time so that we can address some of the family's questions at the time that we're going through the patient, because sometimes they even bring up really valid points that I would have never known unless I was actually there discussing the patient and going through it with the family member themselves. So I think it's a wonderful thing. I try to incorporate as much as possible.
Rob, how about you?
I think that this has to be approached on an individual basis. I think that for some family members and for certain clinical scenarios, it works. And I have done that. You know, I certainly am very active about showing them, for example, CT scans when there's a huge traumatic brain injury or other fractures and things like that. I'm very open to doing that. And again, I think you really have to do it on an individual basis. There are some family members that this will work for. However, there are some other family members and situations in which I really would not do this.
Peter, Rob brings up an important point there. What are your thoughts here?
So I've practiced this at the bedside for about the last 5 or 6 years and try to incorporate the family in this. The challenge is twofold for me. Well, threefold. And Rob brings up a brilliant point about, you know, the family members that don't have the capacity to do this. They feel forced into it or feel guilty if they don't accept your invitation. So making sure that they know that it's not a have to, it's a like to. The other two pieces that I think are critical is number one, that our multidisciplinary rounds are pretty intimidating, and that can be intimidating to the family members, to patients as well, but it can be really intimidating. And then it's kind of like us versus them. So you got to kind of limit the size of your team, I think, if you're interacting with families. And then the third part is, you know, as I'm doing my teaching at the bedside, it can be pretty confusing because oftentimes we use what's going on with the patient as a platform to talk about other process and other disease that the patient doesn't have. So it can be really confusing. So I think the team needs to limit the amount of information that is delivered to family members at the bedside.
Great, great points. Well, let's end this family, in terms of discussion on family presence, with one last recommendation. Rob, most of us are familiar and on board with this, and it incorporates something Peter mentioned a little while ago for this first recommendation. And the authors and the committee members suggest family members of patients be offered the option of being present during resuscitation efforts, importantly, with a staff member assigned to support the family. I think this is probably best studied in the emergency department and pre-hospital setting in terms of these guidelines now seen and incorporated into the care of ICU patients. What are your thoughts on this recommendation?
I'm more open to this. I do this very often. Again, I think the key word here is offered. You should certainly offer that option to them, but not in any way make it seem like they're going to be remiss if they don't participate in this. Family members can have a lot of guilt and lots of, as we mentioned before, post-traumatic stress. You don't necessarily want to add to their guilt in making it anything other than an offer.
John?
Yeah, Mike. So I struggle with this one a little bit. And I know that this concept probably has the largest body of literature that's supportive of having family members in acute resuscitations. And I think a lot of providers have some concern that family members might interfere or get in the way. But I haven't had that experience. I've never had a family member actually get in the way of acute resuscitation. But one of the things I struggle with most, just for example, I always remember back to a 3-year-old boy who had come in with the flu, was really sick, needed to be intubated, central line. And the mother was just floored and sobbing the whole time. And this was at a place that encouraged family members to be involved. And Rob hit it on the head with the discussion of PTSD and introducing family members into this environment. This could leave a lasting memory into that family member. And some people might want to be a part of that, but I don't know that many can even comprehend what they're about to experience. So I'm a little bit more hesitant in certain situations like this about bringing family members in.
Peter, your thoughts on this?
Yeah, I like to differentiate this into two different patient groups. So the chronically ill patient, the families, you know, done the two-step around emergency departments, floors, ICUs, I want them in there. I want them to be a part of it if they're willing to be a part of it. The cases where I'm very hesitant is in sudden death or sudden injury, or more importantly, violent injury, which happens in my community quite a bit, because the catechols are very high during those times and the emotions are peaked. So I'd be very cautious in those cases, very cautious.
You guys have brought up some outstanding points in terms of your real world experience. And in terms of this first big section of these guidelines, family presence, it sounds like it's not an all or none type of phenomenon, but really taking each clinical scenario, the patient, the circumstances, and then what your interactions thus far are with family into account, and considering being open and flexible and keeping family at the bedside, and considering having them participate in interdisciplinary rounds, and certainly offering them the opportunity to be present during resuscitation efforts, but may not be the best really in each and every case. Well, let's move on to the next bigger section, family support. And Rob, I'm going to go to you again first. And one of the recommendations in this section, I think probably the only one we'll talk about in terms of family support, are that they suggest among surrogates of ICU patients who are not doing well, so they have a poor prognosis, using actually a structured communication approach during family discussions to facilitate communications. And they bring in this recommendation of using the value mnemonic, V-A-L-U-E. And I think this may be one of the more important pearls that we have in this podcast. What is the value mnemonic?
Yeah, so this is basically a mnemonic that was developed to try and reduce symptoms of PTSD, and it was shown in a trial to actually accomplish this. And basically, value stands for, V is for value family statements, A is for acknowledge emotions, L is for listen, U is for understand the patient as a person, and E is for elicit questions. And this is a great tool. I actually happen to do some preliminary work in this regard in the same journal, Critical Care Medicine, looking at basically family members' understanding of ICU care and whether they understood everything that was being done to them, to their family members. And it's cited in this article as well. And this is a good approach, good mnemonic to use in terms of communication with families.
Peter, what are your thoughts?
I think it's a clever mnemonic, and it's one that I anticipate pushing out to both the physicians as well as the nursing staff for our ICUs, because it's an easy thing to be top of mind with the interactions.
Yeah, it seems fairly straightforward to remember and provide some structure and consistency for us as providers, regardless of whether we're nurses or physicians, to really communicate with family members. John, what about you?
Well, I think that it's a good step towards providing some structure to a very chaotic time. I think all of these family support tools, whether or not it's providing them information about the equipment or what the ICU actually is or the resuscitation area of the emergency department, all the way down to structured approaches to conversation, it can be really challenging when you're in the moment to kind of recognize all the important points and the important steps when you're trying to touch upon so many things. So these structured approaches can provide a lot of value and simplicity to an otherwise complex interaction.
Outstanding. Let's move on to the other two sections here and get just a few key points from these. And one of those other sections is specialty, consultation, and ICU team member. So John, let me turn to you for these recommendations. In addition to ourselves and our nursing colleagues talking with patients, who else should we be involving?
So yeah, Mike, there's a lot of resources that a lot of our hospitals already have, and sometimes they're underutilized, or many times we may not even aware they actually exist. I think a couple of things that we've been able to do at University of Pennsylvania is we have an in-house social worker that's available 24 hours a day, in-house palliative care, as well as religious affiliates who might be able to come down and provide social support to families. So one of the recommendations here was that there be proactive palliative care consultations that can essentially, hopefully, decrease some of the length of stay issues that can be introduced into chronically or acutely critically ill patients. Social workers are actually a phenomenal resource, not just for the patients themselves, but also to families. Unfortunately, the quality of evidence here is still pretty low in terms of utilization. Another one of these areas that you said is ripe for study. There was a single RCT and one observational study, but definitely a lot more that needs to be done. But essentially, those studies, they demonstrated a non-significant but an overall improvement in the satisfaction of patients and patients' families themselves. There's a few social workers that are quite prominent on social media, particularly from Australia, who's involved in a lot of some of the social media critical care conferences, SMAC conferences, who has just the most phenomenal stories of her interactions with family members. And these people can be quite a resource if you reach out to them.
Peter, are you routinely using palliative care, social work, and perhaps spiritual advisor or chaplain?
So the palliative care service, to reduce the barrier there, we really kind of use the term supportive care services, because not all of it's end of life, and a lot of it goes to support not just the patient, but the family. And so that resonates a little bit better in our shop. I think the social workers can oftentimes be the canary in the mine and pick up, you know, discord in the family before it becomes evident at the bedside. So I really do like that component of the team quite a bit.
Rob, how about you?
Yeah, this has been looked at a lot. Surprisingly, there have been other attempts to look at the interventions of social workers and various other sort of proactive means of communication with family members. And the results of those trials are generally kind of weak evidence, not showing a lot of benefit. Despite those studies, I'm a huge fan of social workers and palliative care and chaplains. I think, you know, it's just, it makes intuitive sense. And what these patients' families often need is somebody there who's going to be able to spend more time with them than we can. Realistically, we're not going to be able to spend more than 15, 20 minutes, maybe half an hour with a family, whereas social workers and other of these support individuals can spend more time with them and provide sort of constant interaction and support. So from that standpoint, I'm a huge fan. I use this all the time.
And Mike, if I could, this is also just a great opportunity to point out that just remember, there is a difference between palliative care and end-of-life care. And I think that that's probably one of the things that this document was, again, pointing out, that controlling patient's symptoms, especially the terminally or chronically critically ill, is very different than planning end-of-life care planning. So I think they've definitely taken on a more aggressive role in treating symptoms to prevent maybe some of the long-term sequelae of critical illness.
Outstanding points and pearls. Well, let's wrap up with this final section here. We're not going to really do a deep dive into it at all because we've talked about it on prior podcasts. And in terms of operational issues, these new guidelines suggest that protocols be implemented to ensure adequate and standardized sedative use along with analgesics. And I think we're all on board with that. And then the final operational issue that we can't overemphasize is that the authors suggest that nurses be involved in decision-making about the goals of care and trained to provide support for family members of critically ill patients. And I think this goes a long way. They're a critical component of the care delivery team, and certainly we should all be on the same page, effectively communicating with patients. And when we are trying to make decisions, understand that in many cases, our nurses have been with these patients the longest and can provide invaluable insight in terms of patients and the family members' overall goals of care. John, would you agree?
100%. I think critical care is a mindset, a specialty, whatever you want to call it. Critical care is physician-led but nursing-driven. And these nurses often become friends of these family members. They spend countless hours at the bedside, so they have tremendous insight into what the family members' goals, wishes, beliefs are, and can be a huge asset for not only creating a plan, but also helping the family members get to whatever decision they need to get to because they become truly trusted. I think it'd be ignorant to think that the physicians are the only ones that can have an impact here. And the nurses are by far, especially the critical care nurses, are just phenomenal resources for decision making.
Rob, any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I would take it a step further. I would suggest that nurses are even better than we are at this. They spend more time with patients' families. They often have greater insight. So I'm definitely all on board about including them in this and even having them take lead roles in this. I think that they, in many ways, in many cases, are better at this than we are.
And Peter.
Yeah, just to echo what both John and Rob have said, it's so very essential to have this multidisciplinary approach so that everybody's on the same page. And again, by default, the individuals who are with the patient and the family the most is going to be our critical care nursing. And so they're going to take a leadership role in this and directing the care to support our patient and the families during these tough times.
All right, gentlemen, this has been an extremely helpful and beneficial discussion in terms of family-centered care. Time to wrap up our discussion. Just some quick take-home points in terms of these newest, latest recommendations for family-centered care. Certainly something that you're going to be hearing about in the coming weeks, in the coming months. We know that a tremendous amount of family members experience distress, PTSD, anxiety, depression that can truly impact their quality of life. In terms of these recommendations, lots of recommendations overall. We'd only just scratch the surface of this document. We'll put the link to the document in our handout for the podcast, but some key things we talked about in terms of family presence, family support in terms of communication with family members, who to get involved early on in terms of specialty or specific consultations, and then just touched on those operational issues. And Rob, we're a bit long here, and I'm going to turn to you for our final take-home point to close us out in terms of this discussion, because I don't want to move past quick something that you said at the onset and to go back. And so often we are always on one side of the curtain, but you've recently been on both sides, in the family side, and you just simply in passing mentioned that you had significant issues as a family member, and so you're close to that. Bring us home with some final thoughts, take home pearls once again in terms of this discussion.
I think the most important thing from my standpoint, as having been through this and just really from reading more about this, is the most important point is to recognize that this is a real problem, that this is a major entity and a major source of ongoing stress and debilitation for our patients' families. So you really have to, like with many other kind of disease processes that are hidden, you have to have a high index of suspicion for this and be very proactive in your measures to combat it. So just be aware that it really exists and that it's a big deal. And for many of our patients, this is probably the most important thing that we can do, that we can support their families and help them through this.
Well said. And with that, we're going to close this podcast out. Please let us know if you have any questions on anything that we talked about. Just email us through the homepage, and we look forward to talking to you on our next podcast. Bye for now.